For our blind and print impaired audience, the North Carolina Reading Service welcomes you to the Indie Week, dated January 27th, 2021, and it's read by John Federson. And you alert listeners can probably tell that we are actually repeating last week's musical artists for our theme music, the fabulous Arachnophonics, of course, appearing via their web service. Now, they are listed as a duet, but of course, with eight legs apiece, I'm not sure actually whether to call them an octet. In any event, I think we can all agree they play pretty. Now, as in last week's issue, which I read from their online publication, stories for this week's issue are in roughly the same order as I'd usually find them in the print edition, but they are datelined a lot later, and I think some of them have been updated. And the first article, Governor Cooper, curfew extended through February and evictions are halted. Lee Toss wrote this. Governor Roy Cooper signed an executive order Wednesday extending the duration of the state's modified stay-at-home order through February the 28th and placing a moratorium on evictions during that time. The news comes as officials say cases of the virus are beginning to level as vaccine rollout continues, and that's a good thing, Cooper said, but residents must remain vigilant, and he said, our COVID numbers have stabilized in recent days, and that's good, but the reality is they're still too high, and too many people are still falling seriously ill and dying. With at least one more contagious variant of COVID-19 in our state, we still have work to do what we can and not let our guard down, especially in these cold winter months. We know this virus is still spreading. The modified stay-at-home order includes a 10 p.m. curfew for residents and mandates alcohol sales cease after 9 p.m. As of Wednesday, the state has reported more than 733,000 cases of the virus since the start of the pandemic. There are currently 3,300 people in the hospital with the virus, and 8,915 people have died. The percent of people testing positive for the virus is hovering at about 11%, and there were 5,600 new cases reported on Wednesday. That's not great, but it's much better than how we were doing a few weeks ago when nearly 18% of folks were testing positive for the virus and North Carolina was reporting more than 10,000 new cases each day. The latest stats are promising, said Secretary of the Department of Health and Human Services Mandy Cohen. Our cases are starting to level, and they are back to where they were in late December. We are past the spike from the winter holidays, but we are still experiencing worrying levels of the virus. Cohen shared the state expects to receive more doses of the vaccine in the coming weeks, but warned that rollout will continue to be limited by supplies. So far, the state has administered 728,000 doses of the vaccine, which includes first and second doses. Notably, Cooper said the state has given out 95% of the first doses received by the federal government. As the rollout continues, Cooper said he plans to push for more relief funds for people and small businesses suffering from the pandemic. And our second article by Sarah Pequeño. Two political parties have lost their spots on the North Carolina ballot following the 2020 election. Constitution Party and Green Party leaders were informed on January 20 that their groups would no longer be recognized by the state of North Carolina after each failed to get at least 2% of the statewide vote for president or governor. The State Board of Elections announced that change on Wednesday morning. Executive Director Karen Brinson Bell said in a statement, the Constitution and Green parties did not meet the threshold to continue as recognized political parties in North Carolina. They may be recognized once again if they meet the requirements for a political party as specified in state statutes. Each party has registered voters in North Carolina, and the Constitution Party had about 4,600 members at the time of the November election, while the Green Party had about 3,600. Nationally, Green Party co-founder and environmental activist Howie Hawkins received 0.2% of the vote in the general election. Hawkins wasn't surprised by these results, according to the Daily Orange at Syracuse University. Meanwhile, the Constitution Party nominated Don Blankenship, a former coal executive who served prison time for his role in West Virginia's Upper Big Branch mine disaster for the 2020 election. He received fewer than 60,000 votes nationwide. Earlier this year, in July, the North Carolina Constitution Party tried to impeach Governor Roy Cooper over the statewide stay-at-home order. Libertarians need not worry. Joe Jorgensen, the party's presidential candidate, appeared on the ballot in at least 35 states, allowing them enough popularity to keep on trucking. The party has just over 45,000 registered voters in North Carolina. The 10,000 voters registered under the two parties will probably be re-registered as unaffiliated per state legislation. This will likely be solidified at the board's meeting on February the 23rd. Next, Tomasi McDonald contributes, Wanted, volunteers to support COVID vaccination efforts. A new project is looking to recruit local volunteers to help. VacCorp is a nonprofit network that aims to connect volunteers, quote, non-traditional vaccinators, along with health science, laboratory personnel, and support staff, with vaccination providers and centers. Quote, by mobilizing volunteers as support staff, vaccination providers can increase capacity without further taxing the healthcare system that is providing for patients, according to the agency's website. And VacCorp wants to enroll 1,000 volunteers by March the 1st and enroll 50 vaccination providers sometime that month. Volunteers can sign up for a variety of roles from greeting to stocking to interpreting on its website. There are also remote options for appointment and volunteer scheduling for those who don't want to or can't volunteer in person. That nonprofit is North Carolina focused for now, but hopes to expand the services nationwide. The website says currently there is no centralized location for providers to find volunteers. Large university and private health systems have their own volunteer signups, but their pool is limited to employees. The nonprofit also notes that the state has a certified vaccinator registry, but it does not include people that can fill non-vaccinating roles. VacCorp points out that professional organizations, such as the North Carolina Board of Pharmacists, have a registry, quote, but it is unknown if non-traditional professions like dentists and veterinarians have a similar system. Connecting volunteers to underserved communities across the state that lack access to large healthcare networks is one of their priorities. The website states there must be a way to connect underserved areas to pools of workers. The organization's strategy includes creating a vaccine registry where volunteers can enter information into a database and to establish a vaccine provider request forms that will enable providers to enter their needs for volunteers. Now, VacCorp was founded by Catherine Leonowens, a Durham-based quantitative clinical pharmacology consultant who previously worked at Genentech, GlaxoSmithKline, and Duke University's Human Vaccine Institute, according to her LinkedIn. Leonowens personally funded the nonprofit and will now rely on fundraising to fuel the agency's growth. Now again to Sarah Pequeño. After a month of public comments, Orange County sends Buc-ee's back to the drawing board. As the nation fixed its eyes on Washington pomp on the eve of Joe Biden's inauguration, some Triangle residents were focused on a local commissioner's meeting that could mean changes for the entire area. On January 19th, the Orange County Board of Commissioners spent hours discussing Effluent Station, a proposed rezoning project anchored by a massive gas station in the northern part of Orange County. The commissioners asked questions and gave comments, grilling the applicant on his plans for the future. They could have voted. They didn't. Instead, the board had some conditions to negotiate with Buc-ee's, a Texas convenience store vying for several parcels of land along Interstate 40 in the unincorporated community of Effluent. They voted to send the company's lawyers back to their lodge to consider the commissioners' requests. Orange County residents didn't speak at last week's meeting, but they'd already made their voices heard. Nearly 100 people had given public comments across three different meetings, overwhelmingly voicing opposition to the plan. And up until last week, those who couldn't attend made phone calls and sent emails to their commissioners. Just 1 in 5 public speakers supported the project. The rest made it clear that Buc-ee's massive development plan was not what they wanted, nor what they expected from the county based on its previously stated goals. A Voice for Effluent and Orange, a newly formed group that's organizing against the development, has mobilized many of the plan's opponents. It isn't often that a rezoning problem takes over the public conversation like this, especially when the focus is on an 800-person unincorporated community that's generally overlooked by other county residents and big businesses. But this isn't an 800-person problem. If this beaver makes its home in Effluent, it could have consequences for Hillsborough, Mebane, and even Raleigh. At best, Effluent Station would be a multi-phase construction project that could include sit-down restaurants, retail outlets, a hotel, and an urgent care facility. Its centerpiece would be Buc-ee's, which describes itself as a travel center with walls of snack options, good-paying jobs, and the cleanest restrooms in America. At worst, Effluent Station would only ever be a 120-gas nozzle behemoth, one of the largest gas stations in the United States, built on top of a watershed that feeds directly into Seven Mile Creek, then the Eno River, then the local water supply. It could be the reason other gas stations in the area closed down. Or worse, a gas spill could threaten the Triangle's clean water and create myriad environmental consequences. Buc-ee's proposed North Carolina outpost would sit atop the upper Eno protected watershed, which exists near the border of a watershed that is critical for drinking water. When surface runoff inevitably occurs, or if an underground tank ruptures, the oil could eventually pool into the Eno River, a 40-mile body of water running through Orange and Durham counties. Buc-ee's representatives say they have never had a reportable underground spill and that they try their best to limit the spills on the surface. They also contest the idea that the project would have a potentially negative effect on local water systems. The company said in a statement that it's, quote, physically impossible for it to happen. Since the site is downstream of Hillsborough's water source and Orange Alamance Water System intake facility, they say they confirmed this with the Orange County Planning Department. But at a January 12th public hearing, an Orange County Planning Board member said the company left some important details out. Kim Peracci said, at the November 4th Planning Board meeting, the developer stated this project was not in the upper Eno Critical Protected Watershed. This, of course, is a true statement. What they did not tell us, but the Triangle Land Conservancy did, was that this project has two tributaries that empty into the Seven Mile Creek, which serves as a water supply for Hillsborough and then eventually Raleigh. Environmental groups have concerns about the plans. Orange County Commission for the Environment recommended the county deny this project, as did the Eno River Association. College students majoring in environmental studies, university professors, and members of the Sierra Club have also shared their worries with the county commissioners. Other residents told the commission during the public meetings that they're worried about potential traffic congestion. Buc-ee's could close westbound exit 160, I-40's I-85's exit for Eflin. Residents say this could be a nuisance and potentially dangerous for residents. Others aren't buying the economic benefits promised by the company. Several residents brought up Bucky's glass door page during the meetings. Comments from alleged current and former employees mention that their breaks are short and that management can be strict and uncompromising with employees. Some speculated that the Lone Star State's company profits wouldn't stay in Orange County. John LaRusso said at the final hearing, "They're interested in gaining money for themselves and essentially taking it back to Texas. We as a county need to think about ourselves. No one else is going to think about us. We need local business owners to build things in our county." Some residents just think it'll be a headache, an I-40 version of South of the Border, or a truck stop with tacky advertisements up and down the interstate. Many mentioned they originally chose to live in northern Orange County because it's quiet and rural. Bucky's contests this, since the area includes an interstate and an active railroad. Bucky's lawyer, Beth Trahos, told county commissioners, "It's more like a general store where fresh food is prepared on site, local arts and crafts with North Carolina artisans, household goods. They're actually the third largest retail of lodge cookware. They have hunting and fishing gear, games, toys, books, etc. Bucky's is to Sheetz what Wegmans is to a Piggly Wiggly," Trahos continued. "These things are not the same." Bucky's supporters want residents to focus on the jobs the development will bring to the area, jobs that meet living wage requirements for Orange County and ones that potentially offer benefits. Commissioner Mark DeRosen said at the January 19th meeting, "I've been troubled by the criticism of some about these jobs, which again will pay $15 an hour, the Orange County living wage, which we've just heard will provide benefits, which I don't believe are even provided to the folks who, you know, clean our schools." Trahos brought up what she perceived to be an inconsistency on the part of Orange County residents. She says Wegmans has a starting salary of $9 an hour, and that the company received tax incentives from Chapel Hill, but those jobs aren't scrutinized. Commissioner Earl McKee reminded the board that the county is losing its younger residents without college degrees who are being priced out to Alamance and Chatham counties. Though outnumbered by detractors, several residents spoke in favor of the proposal, too. "The land has been on the market for years," they said. They mentioned that the Board of Commissioners had rejected multiple other proposals for the area. Eflin resident Kenneth Woods said at the final hearing, "I hear some of you saying, let's wait for something better. Will there ever be anything better for us in Orange County, especially in Northern Orange?" Despite the general store sales pitch, Bucky's spokespeople are tied to the gas pumps. When asked by multiple commissioners whether scaling down was possible, a Bucky's representative says the size of the store, including its 5 dozen gas pumps, is what, quote, makes it work. Commissioner Amy Fowler told her colleagues that she would consider the project if the gas station could be scaled down to at least a third of its proposed size. Although Bucky's spokespeople said that sort of scaling back wasn't possible, it's one of the conditions they now have to consider. It's unclear if the Texas-sized Bucky's can fit in the progressive Orange County framework. Commissioners recommended adapting the height of the Bucky's sign, adding solar panels to the first phase, securing partners for the second phase, having fully functioning electric vehicles, charging stations, and reducing the size of the project. The decision to consider the conditions passed 5-2. Chair Renee Price and Commissioner Gene Hamilton were the only dissenters. The other five, even those in support of higher wages, were on the fence about the project overall. Bucky's and the planning department will return to the board at the February 16th meeting to see if they can make it work. If the commissioners deny the plan or if Bucky's withdraws his proposal, the parcels of land can't be rezoned this way for a year, according to county planner Michael Harvey. a different company could buy the land to use for the current zoning, which allows for office buildings and factories. The commission may or may not consider other types of rezoning for the site in the future. It's also unclear if Buc-ee's has an eye on other parts of North Carolina. If the commissioners approve the project, a voice for Eflin and Orange doesn't have a concrete plan yet for how it would respond. Organizer Jared Cates says, "We've talked about what we do if it goes forward. We have also talked about what we do if it doesn't go forward, and how we can stay connected as a group of rural folks who have made some connections with folks in Chapel Hill and Carrboro to stay more engaged in our county processes and hold our elected officials in our county departments accessible." Wake County received the third fewest vaccines per person in North Carolina, writes Litos. Wake has the highest population in North Carolina, but it received the third fewest doses of COVID vaccine per person statewide through the week of January 18. No wonder the rollout is going slowly. Following a report from local health officials, Wake County Board of Commissioners Chair Matt Calabria requested a list of how many vaccines were received by each county in the state. In crunching the numbers by population size, he found Wake County ranked 98th out of 100 counties in the state in terms of vaccine distribution per capita, while Durham County receives 41,800 doses of the vaccine, approximately one for every eight residents. Wake got 40,850, just one dose for every 27 people in the county. Wake County's rollout has been slower than some surrounding counties, in part because the county is taking a cautious approach by administering the vaccine by appointment only and not opening up mass vaccination centers. However, Calabria said Wake has the capacity to vaccinate more people than it currently is, but is limited by the number of doses it has received. Quote, "There's no doubt that the defining factor in all this is supply and demand. If we get fewer doses of the vaccine, the result will be that we are able to provide fewer doses." On Tuesday, Department of Health and Human Services Secretary Mandy Cohen announced the state would be modifying its distribution plan to better account for population disparities. Calabria is hoping that this will mean more vaccines will become available for Wake County residents in the coming weeks. "We have the capacity, we have the ability, we just need more vaccine," he said. According to DHHS, Wake County has administered 68,775 doses of vaccine total as of today, including 57,800 first doses and 11,000 second doses. Right now, healthcare workers and residents 65 years and older can get on the waiting list to receive the vaccine by appointment. Greg Barnes now writes this article. EPA rejects NC Environmental Group's petition for forever chemicals study. U.S. Environmental Protection Agency has rejected a petition from six North Carolina environmental groups that would have forced the Chemours chemical company to fund health studies on 54 types of, quote, forever chemicals released from its Fayetteville Works plant. The EPA said in a January 7th response that the petitioners failed to prove the requested data was needed. The petition was filed on October 14th by the Center for Environmental Health, Cape Fear River Watch, Clean Cape Fear, North Carolina Black Alliance, Democracy Green, and Toxic Free NC. The group sought a rule of order under the Toxic Substance Control Act, compelling Chemours to fund and carry out health and environmental testing of the 54 per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances, commonly known as PFAs, through a panel of independent scientists. Leaders of the groups had strong words following the EPA's denial. Emily Donovan, co-founder of Clean Cape Fear, said in an email, "I believe the EPA is lying to North Carolinians and by extension the rest of America. If, as the EPA suggests, enough scientific data already exists to deny our petition, then where are the drinking water standards for these 54 PFAs, fish and wildlife consumption advisories, fact sheets for medical practitioners and state health departments? The required data doesn't exist to produce these vital protections. The EPA knows it, and my children are still being exposed to many of these PFAs. My friends and neighbors are sick. My husband almost lost his eyesight to a brain tumor, and I'm tired of a government funded by taxpayer dollars refusing to do its job." The environmental groups say Chemours and, before it, DuPont, are responsible for PFAS contamination in the Cape Fear River, downstream of the Bladen County Chemical Plant, and in more than 4,000 private wells surrounding it. Before 2015, DuPont owned and managed the Fayetteville Works facility. Then, the company spun off Chemours into a separate entity. Nearly 300,000 people surrounding the plant and living downstream of it are believed to have been exposed to elevated levels of PFAS from decades of unregulated PFAS being discharged into the river and the air. The substances have also been found in vegetables grown near the plant and in fish, alligators, and other wildlife downstream. Potential adverse health effects from PFAS include liver damage, thyroid disease, decreased fertility, high cholesterol, obesity, hormone and immune suppression, and cancers of the liver, kidneys, pancreas, testicles, and thyroid. Chemours contends the levels of PFAS found in drinking water drawn from the Cape Fear River and in private well water are not enough to cause human harm. Yet mounting evidence suggests that even extremely low levels of certain types of PFAS may cause adverse health effects. The groups that filed the 49-page petition want Chemours to pay for studies on the 54 PFAS so people can know the health risks and perhaps how to mitigate them. The action would emulate studies conducted in the mid-Ohio River Valley in the earlier part of this century, which found most of the people studied had some level of PFAS contamination in their blood. Donovan, who lives in Brunswick County, said, "Medical practitioners in our region know we were overexposed to PFAS, but lack the guidance and support on how to offer preventative medical care." A study last year by the National Environmental Working Group found that water from a drinking fountain in a Brunswick County elementary school contained the highest level of PFAS detected in the nation. Donovan said, "There's a data gap inside our healthcare community regarding exposures to mixtures of PFAS. We deserve to know all the risk factors." Chemours disagrees. Shortly after the EPA rejected the group's petition, the company released a statement saying it was happy with the outcome. The statement also touted Chemours' efforts to substantially reduce PFAS from the Cape Fear River. And it said in a statement, "The petition failed to establish any of the factors required under TSCA to support the proposed action. Several of the compounds cited in the petition have no known connection to Chemours Fayetteville Works operation. Others are byproducts and intermediaries that occur at such small quantities, levels that continue to decrease. It would be incredibly difficult, if not impossible, to manufacture the volumes required for testing." Following the EPA's decision, the groups who filed the petition vowed to continue fighting on behalf of at-risk communities against PFAS pollution from Chemours. The groups said in a joint statement published by the Center for Environmental Health, "EPA's petition denial does not dispute the serious health effects concerns associated with PFAS or the extensive contamination of the Cape Fear River Basin caused by Chemours. Instead, it seeks to justify its refusal to require testing with the self-serving recitation of its actions on PFAs generally, actions which have been widely criticized as ineffective and inadequate. The statement continued, under Donald Trump, protecting the profit margins of corporate polluters has repeatedly taken precedence over public health. EPA's refusal to require Chemours to fund testing that should have been conducted decades ago is one more example of its willingness to sacrifice public health to protect industry's bottom line. The groups said they will ask President Joe Biden's administration to approve the petition. Biden has nominated Michael Regan, Secretary of the North Carolina Department of Environmental Quality, to lead the EPA. Biden has said he will declare two of the oldest and most troublesome PFAs, perfluorooctanoic acid and perfluorooctane sulfonate, PFOs, hazardous substances under the federal Superfund law, which could provide a major boost in cleanup of the toxic chemicals. An estimated 5,000 different types of PFAs are known to exist. They're used to make products grease or water resistant and are found in many everyday products, including non-stick cookware, water-repellent clothing, stain-resistant carpets, lubricants, firefighting foams, paints, cosmetics, paper plates, and fast food packaging. Nearly everyone in America is thought to have some level of PFAS in their blood, but few states have as much of the contamination in drinking water as North Carolina. PFAS are called forever chemicals because they don't break down easily in the environment and accumulate in the body. Elevated levels of PFAS have been found in drinking water throughout the Cape Fear River Basin, from Greensboro to the coast. In a video conference last month announcing findings from a study of PFAS in Pittsburgh residents' blood, Duke University researcher Heather Stapleton said 1 million people who draw their drinking water from the basin could potentially be exposed to elevated levels of PFAS. She also said the types of PFAS found in the blood of Pittsburgh residents are strikingly similar, that's in quotes, to those found in the blood of Wilmington residents. Yet some types of PFAS, including Gen X and Nafion byproducts, are almost exclusively released by Chemours in North Carolina. Both compounds were found at extremely high levels in drinking water downstream of the Bladen County plant before the company was forced to stop releasing its wastewater into the river in 2017. Elevated levels of those substances are still found in the river, however, coming largely from groundwater seepage, runoff, and sediment. Last year, the State Department of Environmental Quality took additional action against Chemours that it says will significantly curtail the PFAS loading into the river. But the environmental groups that filed the petition want more than promises to stop the pollution. They want industries to be held accountable, and they want to know what decades of contaminated drinking water could be doing to their health. Dana Sargent, executive director of Cape Fear River Watch, said in that statement, "Chemical giants continue to reap financial benefits of their reckless behavior at the expense of human health and the environment. This petition holds at least one polluter responsible for paying to figure out just what damage they have done to the health of those in their community in North Carolina." A footnote says this study was originally published by NC Health News. We will move now to an op-ed column which does not attribute authorship that I can find, but it was written by members of the Youth Justice Project of the Southern Coalition for Social Justice and is titled "Liberate Our Education from Deep Racial Bias and Disparities." It's about time, America. In this year of turmoil and despair, we are reckoning with the epidemic that has oppressed black people throughout history, systemic racism. In 2020, "I Can't Breathe" became a rallying cry for black liberation, and it echoes the cries of black people throughout centuries demanding human rights. The United States has claimed to offer the American dream to all its inhabitants, yet education, one of its most important facets, has been denied to black people for generations. As black students, we've been pushed out of education, affecting the way we learn, earn, and yearn for acceptance in this country. Liberation in education is not a new concept. We've seen it debated, rejected, and somewhat accepted in efforts to integrate schools during the civil rights era. Despite the generational effort to liberate black students, we are still subject to myriad barriers that block us from quality education. White and black students misbehave at similar rates, but in North Carolina, roughly 10 black youth were incarcerated for every white youth in 2017, according to U.S. Justice Department data. And Durham Public Schools, during the 2018-19 academic year, black students comprised 86% of youth who found themselves on the receiving end of school-based complaints to the justice system, despite representing 44% of enrollment, according to DPS data compiled by the Southern Coalition for Social Justice. Not a single white student received a school-based complaint in the same year. This environment of racist policing caused one black DPS student to say, "I believe my safety is not being put first when law enforcement officers are placed in school because they specifically target students that look like me." Racial disparities are fueled by oppressive forces like racial profiling, scarce mental health resources, and academic tracking that funnels students of color into less academically challenging courses. By putting the focus back on students and giving them mental health spaces, easy access to opportunities and resources, better restorative justice program, and a manageable workload, we could help create an equitable school environment. As Malcolm X once said, "Education is the passport to the future, for tomorrow belongs to those who prepare for it today." We must reform the education of our nation to secure black students' liberation. The prejudicial foundation of the education system is impeding upon black success. Understanding the value of a great education, we at the Youth Justice Project at the Southern Coalition for Social Justice have started the Liberate to Educate plan. That's with a hashtag. This plan addresses educational barriers by demanding police-free schools, alternatives to harmful school discipline, student self-determination in course selection, and culturally relevant curriculum, as well as mental health spaces and safe spaces for marginalized students. In order to systemically dismantle the school-to-prison pipeline in DPS, we need the support of elected officials and the community. Join our movement by signing our petition and telling Durham school board members they must liberate to educate. No black student in DPS should fear physical abuse by a police officer while having no mental health support. DPS should be a place where all black students are free to pursue the American dream. Over to Raleigh and Lee Taus's column, "A Raleigh Parks Bond on the 2021 ballot could fund the first phase of Dix Park redevelopment." Before COVID altered life as we know it, 2020 was supposed to be the year Raleigh taxpayers co-signed the biggest check in the city's history, an ambitious bond package that included funds for affordable housing, parks and greenway maintenance, and the first phase of Dorothea Dix Park's redevelopment. Mayor Mary Ann Baldwin and an incoming slate of development-friendly council members were quick to throw the weight of their campaign promises behind the referendum. Plans were quickly downsized, however, once the pandemic hit. Instead of the moonshot trifecta, voters were left with an $80 million housing bond, which they overwhelmingly approved, and an I owe you for Parks. Now Baldwin hopes to pick back up where she left off, resurrecting a Parks bond likely to top $100 million. Baldwin told Indy, during COVID, I think Parks and Greenways became everybody's oasis. That's where people go to escape. It's where we go to walk, play, ride, socially distance with friends, and I think we'll get support because people realize how important Parks and Greenways are to the community. It's still a big ask, especially with no clear end to the pandemic in sight and a projected $28 million budget shortfall. The first phase of Dix Park, which includes the creation of the Gateway Plaza and Play Area, cost $55 million alone. If the bond includes the second installment of the John Chavis Memorial Park project, which is estimated to cost $45 million, that's already $100 million, without even taking into account other much-needed parks maintenance projects. The current proposal falls about $20 million short of what the Dix Park Conservancy had planned for, said the nonprofit president and CEO, Janice Cowell. In total, Phase 1 is expected to cost $200 million, of which the Conservancy will fund $50 million. That would leave the city on the hook for $150 million, which Cowell said could come from two bonds over 5 years. If Dix gets less than $75 million this year, Cowell said the city and Conservancy will both need to make up the shortfall. She said, we'll certainly push to get as close to that $75 million as possible. If it's not possible, I think we should look at a tax increment, financing districts, and figuring out other ways to complete the master plan that everybody agreed on. The city's Parks, Recreation, and Greenway Advisory Board is dreaming even bigger, up to $200 million in bond funding, which doesn't even include a proposed $50 million for the first wave of Dix Park. Separate from the bond, the board is also asking the city council to consider a 1 or 2 cent property tax to help fund park maintenance. Representatives from the Parks Board could not be reached for comment before Indy went to press. Last week, Council Member Patrick Bufkin acknowledged the council and advisory board were unlikely to see eye to eye on bond priorities. He said at the January 19th council meeting, I want to suggest that everyone be comfortable with the possibility the council is going to disagree with the Parks Board. It is a recommendation from an advisory board. It will carry a great bit of weight, but the council retains final prerogative to set the list, and make decisions about how much in total. Councilmember David Cox, the often odd outvote District B representative, took issue with the lack of projects proposed for his district. Unless the number of proposed projects for District B has changed, I would not be in support of a parks bond going forward. The council plans to take up the matter at its March retreat. The bond would appear as a referendum on the ballot for Raleigh's October 5 municipal election, which will also include the council and mayoral races. The council must vote on a preliminary bond resolution by June and a final proposal by August for it to get on the ballot. While the council has the final say over what goes into the bond, ultimately it's up to voters to foot the bill. Baldwin says the voters will decide, and it'll be their choice. We're going to make sure we make a compelling case that we're fiscally responsible and we're fully informing them and transparent. Cowell says, given low interest rates, the time to go big on a parks bond is now. I know there's been a lot of hurt in the community for small businesses and individuals, and as we look to recover from COVID, I think investing is a good thing. This is the time for government to step forward. Now, ladies and gentlemen, the largest article in this issue of Indie Week is titled, What Campaign Finance Records Can Tell Us About Who Controls North Carolina Elections. I'm not going to be able to read this story, even excerpted. It's so long and contains really very, very many graphs and charts, which I would have to explain where every dot appeared on a chart for it to make sense. But IndieWeek.com, of course, is online, and that's where I printed out this version of the newsletter today. It is written by Jeremy Borden, Michael Taff, and Kathy Kian, and it stretches on my printout for about 11 pages. And so, reluctantly, we'll have to put that one aside, but you can find it there at IndieWeek.com. And perhaps at the newsstands, where IndieWeek appears as a free publication. Instead, I'll move up to the IndieWeek's collection of articles, mostly audio and music-based today. The first one, there being three reviews of recent musical releases, and the first one by Brian Howe talks about Speed Stick. Volume 1 from Don Giovanni Records, released on January 22. How Speed Stick shot from experimental rock to its startlingly poppy debut album, writes Brian Howe. At first blush, Volume 1 sounds like the kind of what-the-hell project that droves of cooped-up musicians have been doing since March. Record 10 double drummer tacks, send them out to friends to finish, and then wrestle the results into an album. But the road leading to Carborough supergroup Speed Stick's debut, released last week by New Jersey's Don Giovanni Records, was longer and more unique than that, with the group featuring members of Bat Fangs, The Love Language, Polvo, and the Paul Swest, plus contributors as august as Superchunk's Mac McCowan and The Breeders' Kelly Deal. A spirit of merry contradiction reigns on Volume 1. Far-flung genres crash together, from gnarly noise rock to cozy indie pop to, why not, a hip-hop song, a song by the moody party rap lifer Juan Huevos. Elsewhere, artists with well-worn wheel tracks make hard turns. Though the songs are composed, even poppy, the album is as improvised as the core group's music. This anything-goes approach led to the ultimate paradox. One of the heavier, experimental rock bands around has made one of the more effervescent local albums in recent memory. And it all started, as even the project's biggest projects often do, with a single, intuitive connection. In 2014, Laura King and Thomas Simpson were both among the 16 full-kit drummers playing in a hopscotch concert called Four. King, who now pounds hard rocks in Bat Fangs, was the punk band Flesh Wounds then, while Simpson roams glossier indie rock pastures in The Love Language. Still, stationed side by side, they connected so well, they knew they wanted to perform as a duo, though at first it wasn't quite clear how. They came from rock context, where having two drummers was rare enough, but only two drummers? That's not even a thing. In 2016, Charles Chase of the free jazz band The Paul Swest asked King to perform at a residency he was curating at the station. She quickly enlisted Simpson. They practiced twice at Nightlight. King came up with the name Speed Stick because they were sweating so much, and then never practiced again. At that first show, they established their tradition of playing face-to-face, sharing a single bass drum. Two performers with one heartbeat. King says, we're a lot alike as drummers, but we also complement each other very well. We never know what we're going to play till we get together. More shows followed, while Chase and Polvo's Ash Bowie osmosed from collaborators to official members, sealing the deal at one of those big shows at the Cave back when everyone thought it was going to close. King says, when we start playing, there's no direction, but someone will do something and we'll all catch on to it. It's the sort of follow the leader thing we play live. By January 2019, Speed Stick was ready to record. Knowing that the furious spontaneity of their live duo might not translate, they set up a plan to create by committee when they began recording in Chase's home studio, tailoring each track to friends. They were surprised and delighted by what they got back, as a record that they never would have thought to make was taking shape. King says, we'd be like, this beat's for Mac. He loves punk rock. So we did a punk rock beat, which he totally turned around with his synth. Another surprise is Ryan Gustafson's song. That's an understatement. The cryptic folk rocker, The Dead Tongues, drifts closer to ambient house than anyone ever would have guessed with Let It Shine. King and Simpson made the track, imagining him playing banjo. Even Jason Bowie got in on the table turning after their bandmates served them the kind of freak out they usually feast on. Jason said, "It had no steady beat. Drums completely falling apart. I shocked them by looping stuff and making it into a song." The result? Opener Protect Your Magic kicks off the record with a fanfare of squalling noise, flinty, post-punk, and free jazz Chinese horn. It also sports a vibrantly deranged video, the first King has ever made. It's not a huge leap from there to Knots, where Deal and R. Ring collaborator Mike Montgomery also employ drum loops in their atmospheric vamp, but it is a leap from Knots to the pert synthy twin collision, where Love Language leader Stuart McLam goes meta. King says, "I really love Stu's song because he wrote it about Tommy and I playing drums together. Twin collision. It's what we are when we get on stage and go." Ben Felton also blurs boundaries with his flashing anthem, Plants, based on a driving drum break from a phone recording he made of one of Speedstick's earliest shows. Not everything came as a shock. Nora Rogers and Jenny Waters turned in the kind of epic dual guitar grooves that fueled their recent debut as Object Hours. Pipes' Ron Liberti enlisted Casey Cook for some pogo-ready pop punk, while Clark Blomquist came up with a typically unidentifiable musical substance. Chase wonders, what did Clark even do with the drum recordings? Maybe it just inspired him to make a song, and the beats slowed down in the background or something. They didn't bother to find out. By then, they were all in on making an album without knowing what kind it was, only that it would be collectively dreamed into being, powered by enthusiasm and oblivious of destinations or goals. The patchwork of Volume 1 may be a one-time slot, but it leaves a dazzling streak. Now a shorter review from Dan Melchior's Odes. Is unvarnished and earnest, but also meticulously composed. The seventh track on this new album consistently makes me tear up. Like all the instrumentals on Odes, Tybee is relatively simple. Spare, echoing picks on electric guitar amble patiently at the start, before lead lines surge, raw and bright, sprinting, but never quite catching up. The song evokes a feeling of trying to get back something you've lost. My reaction to Tybee is admittedly wrapped up in the story that surrounds it, Melchior, the cult-favorite garage rock adventurer who currently lives in Carrboro, recorded these songs shortly after moving from Durham to Akron, Ohio, in 2016, following the 2014 death of his wife, the artist Letha Rodman Melchior, following a protracted battle with cancer. The impact of losing Letha didn't fully hit me until I was away from North Carolina. The album statement reads, "I had to find ways of channeling my feelings so I wouldn't become completely overwhelmed." The resulting 9 songs played into a, quote, partially working 4-track and a karaoke machine that had very good reverb, navigate the expanse between grief and acceptance, demonstrating that few, if any, guitarists have better mastered the expressive potential of lo-fi recording. One album opener, Louisiana Honeymoon, earthy acoustic guitar undulates as the reverb shifts and effect-drenched notes prickle, charting a melody that's alien by comparison. Louder, more intensely distorted guitar slinks through Jaguar Girl. Night Song and Happy Goodnight let electric guitars ripple and dissipate through the analog haze, like memories fraying and fragmenting over time. Coney Island evokes the titular setting, with its mix of gritty history and youthful exuberance, setting day-glow lead lines over strums that crackle and crunch. Released 4 years after it was recorded and dedicated to Letha, Odes is unvarnished and earnest, but also meticulously composed, offering powerful emotion and immersive texture. It is a rare and intimate gift. And I'll be able to read most of this last little review on Selections from Symphonic Electronic, Melodic Immediacy, Douglas Von Cannon's Lodestar, writes Brian Howe. In November, the Durham-based composer and seeming pan-instrumentalist Von Cannon released Selections from Symphonic Electronic, a compact, gem-like extended play of highlights from studio recordings dating back to the 2000s. Though Von Cannon is versatile on local stages, playing with quirky post-traditionalists such as Felix Obelix and Curtis Eller, his own music, his determined pursuit of the singularity where his favorite genres merge, classical, jazz, post-rock, and synthesizer music from the 60s, a time when there was no such thing as a consumer-grade Moog, and musical mad scientists paid loving attention to the strange new sounds, every murmur. But Melodic Immediacy is Von Cannon's Lodestar, with results closer to The Apples in Stereo than Silver Apples of the Moon. The centerpiece is Breakfast Nook, where a wistful but brightening melody wends through more than 6 minutes of dreamy rainbow variation. With its drifting ribbon of guitar, cloud puff strings, jazzy changes, and subtly blended electronic warbles, it is the most complete statement of Von Cannon's sophisticated synthesis. But it's also a mere Soof John Stevens or Andrew Bird away from being an indie pop song. Other mirages beckon, Journey to a Specific Place, a 33-second utopian overture, is like a tone poem about the green zone of a classy Sega Genesis game. Armored Cars and Igloos might be the theme song of a 70s sitcom set on the Boon. The composer played most of the instruments, piano, harpsichord, harmonium, synths, guitars, double bass, drums, many winds. And here comes our musicians to remind us that it's time to close. Unfortunately, we thank Arachnophonics, who have again been called on to close Indie Week for this broadcast. Like most of their genre, it's been egg-laying season, and they want to ensure their young'uns will be provided for. Meanwhile, John Federson reminds you that this program will be available at ncreadingservice.org at the podcast tab. Until issue, next issue, John Federson says so long from Indie Week.